Welcome to Docil Tones, episode 245 of the Sport on Me podcast. This is your host, Khalif Adams. I join this week and every week my man, my mellow, the smooth kind of fellow, the man who does not go to the Houston Rockets because he's chilling with the Knicks in the summer league. Then he's going to the Rucker. Then he's going to the Crenshaw Mafia. And then he's going to go to two other places. It is Cicero Holmes. How are you doing,
sir? Yeah, you talk about the Rucker. You know who was at the Rucker? Uncle Drew. And last week, I was not Uncle Drew, but I was Uncle Cicero. And I was shaking and baking my niece and nephews. We was doing that. We didn't go see Uncle Drew because they had all seen it already. We went to see Hotel Transylvania 3.
Ooh.
I liked it. It was pretty cool.
I heard that was good. Was it super dope?
Yeah, it was dumb funny. It was really dumb. And it was really funny.
I don't like the idea of them like outside of the hotel on like a boat or whatever.
Yeah, it worked.
Not a fan.
It worked.
I didn't see it though.
It worked.
Okay.
Definitely. Cool. And then one of my nephews and I went to go see Ant-Man and the Wasp in 3D, IMAX.
3D, huh?
Yeah, IMAX 3D. Yo, 3D is the definitive way to see Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Really?
The definitive way.
I haven't seen a 3D movie in a long time.
Absolutely. But,
yeah,
but
I haven't done that either.
Yeah, yo, it was dope. It was definitely worth going to see it in 3D. But all that to say, Stubby Stan is broke, but apparently Uncle Cicero is a baller. Because he
money bags.
Uncle Cicero balled out while he was watching his niece and nephews, and now Stubby Stan is broke as a joke.
Scrooge McCicero.
Yo, literally last week, I was eating. We went to a teppanyaki place, like a Benihana or whatever. I was eating sushi and teppanyaki. And this week I'm eating Top Ramen. So
it's okay.
Oh my god.
You gotta moderate.
Someone who is not eating Top Ramen is my man, my mellow, the smooth kind of fellow, the man who makes science look good, the man who makes math look good, the man who makes tutoring look good, the man who makes looking good. It is Sharif Jackson of SharifJackson.com. MC Dulcet Tones. What up, Sharif?
Good, man. Last time I had a lot of ramen. When I used to run track in high school, I don't know why we thought that this was like the right thing to do, but we would like, you know, run 5 miles and then, you know, and we'd lift weights and we'd have like 2 hours of like practice. And then after practice, we would go to like the school, like, you know, snack place and just eat mm-hmm. one of those like really cheap, like ramen things and like the white, you know, like the white bowl that you put in the microwave and put like a water in it and stuff. And we did that every day. Like I don't understand why we did that. It was super weird.
Yo, you needed the salt replenished in your
I feel
body
like it like destroyed my whole workout, like doing that. And like I would sometimes have like
That's
a thing of M&M's or something.
Though, right?
it was like perfect post workout food. You know what I mean?
Ugh.
So yeah.
I feel like that's like how they just preserved mummies. It was just like ramen dust. It was just like,
I gotta check the Assassin's Creed Origins Discovery mode and like see if they go over that. just a bunch of like people getting wrapped in ramen, like ramen noodles. Could be.
Oh my god.
Mummy shrimp flavor.
That's right.
Oh, that is so terrible. Anyway, I'm super excited. Thank you, everybody, for coming through and hanging out with us this week and every week. We had a fantastic show last week with Emma from Game Workers Unite. A lot of folks on the Twitters and on the Facebooks really loved the episode and really appreciated the conversation that we had. So thank you to her and to everyone who was rocking with us and listening to that show and sharing out the good word. Some good stuff that happened. We got put into one of the top 10 lists of gaming podcasts you should listen to on the Daily Dot. That's pretty dope.
Dope.
So shout out to those folks for giving us some love over there. And again, we have some fun stuff, and wait around to the end of the episode because we have an announcement. An announcement is about to happen. We're going to decree some things and say a couple of other stuff too up in there.
Off with their heads.
Oh shit! Word.
That's a decree. that's how you decree things. Okay.
Okay. Reef just came through with the fucking spawn on me red wedding.
Off with their heads. Sweet Jesus. Or like, lend me your ears. Those are decrees.
Okay. I just want cake. You just killing people. Right. Like, I think.
Most let decrees involve killing people. It's just how it is.
Damn. So we see what happens when Reef gets power.
Really?
None of this like benevolent shit. Reef is just like, yo, we gotta kill people. Alright, fine. God, jeez. We have a fantastic show this week because we have a dope guest. Someone that we have been trying to get on the show for a very long time. If you have been paying attention to podcasting and gaming discussions and the diversity discussion, you would know that one of the first crews to put out the conversation about diversity were these lovely women who have been doing their stuff for a very long time, and it's just now that we've been able to snag them. We have Samantha Blackman from Not Your Mama's Gamer, chilling with us this evening. Hey. Samantha, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am so happy that you are here. Let me tell you and thank you first, because I think like there was literally just you and your crew. And I think we kind of snuck in right in after y'all in terms of the conversation about diversity in this space. So we owe a lot to all of the work that you have all done and Not Your Mama's Gamer. And we really want to give you all massive amount of love and massive amount of props for starting and sparking that conversation and being at the forefront of it and continuing to put out fantastic work for all these dope years. So first, thank you for all that. And again, thank you for coming and rocking with us tonight. So we're super happy to have you.
Well, thanks for having me and thanks for joining the struggle.
Nice. Oh, man. Super, super, super dope. So I want to get into a little bit of where Not Your Mama's Gamer started from, where you got into the mix and how everything kind of came to be. If you want to give the folks at home listening here on Twitch and at home in podcast land a little bit of background on yourself.
A little bit of background on myself. Wow. So I'm an academic by training, but I always call myself an anti-academic. I'm an anti-academic. In terms of where Not Your Mama's Gamer came from, a lot of years ago, I've been listening to podcasts forever, but whenever I was listening to podcasts, I was like, okay, so where's my voice, right? So as, you know, as a woman of color, right, where is the discussion that talks about games from a different perspective? So I would just kind of sit back and complain about it at first. It's like, I don't see this. Yeah. And then, having a conversation with one of my grad students, she was like, well, why don't you do a podcast? And I was like, well, why don't you do a podcast? Like, that sounds like a whole lot of work. So I was talking to her and I said, well, I'll make you a deal. I'll think about doing a podcast if you sit down and plan this with me. And you know, so, you know, thinking at that point, she was gonna be like, no, that's okay. And she said, all right, let's do this. So we spent, you know, 5-6 months planning it out, thinking about what it would look like, thinking about like frequency, thinking about what we wanted to talk about, who our audience was going to be, all these different things. Right. And then, yeah, we kind of kicked it off in the January of that following year. And we've been going strong ever since. It's been almost 8 years now.
Wow. That's so dope. That's
crazy. So yeah, it's been a wild ride. You know, I, 8 years ago, I don't know that I thought we would still be going at this point. But we're still going strong, we're still growing, right?
Right.
And that's been pretty interesting.
Wow. So 8 years ago, do you remember some of the big topics you guys were talking about in 2010?
Oh gosh, in 20, like, no. Yeah. Like, yeah, you know, in 2010, I mean, seriously, because there weren't podcasts that were talking about like women the representation of women in games. They weren't podcasts talking about, you know, being a woman playing games. They weren't podcasts talking about, you know, being black or being a person of color or being queer or any of those things in games, or in games themselves in terms of representation or being a person in that game space doing these things.
In 2010, there were no women. No women in podcasts.
There weren't.
There, you would not listen to a podcast and hear a feminine voice.
Right. I mean, if you did on any rare occasion in like 2010 or 2011, even, I mean, it was like somebody visiting somebody's podcast, and you know, they were never hosts. They were, you know, never regulars. So yeah, it was pretty interesting as a space. It was pretty interesting as a space. So it was like, we see this hole, let's fill it with, you know, content we want to see in this space.
What have been some of the great successes and some of the great challenges that you've seen for the podcast over the last 8 years?
Great successes and great challenges. I think it's probably some of the more interesting things for us have been the ways that we see, because like I said, you know, by trade, I'm an academic, right? But not everybody on staff, like even at the podcast or on the blog, that not everybody's an academic. You know, we got people who coming at it from different angles. I think probably one of the greatest successes is bringing together a bunch of different voices, right? Mm. Because like I always say, like I said, I'm an anti-academic by trade, because, you know, I'm not into just speaking from an ivory tower to others in an ivory tower. Because I see no import in that. So
then you just use import. You talk about not being in ivory towers. I'm just playing.
okay, you got me. But you know, So it's been an interesting ride for us to see how, like, Not Your Mama's Gamer can kind of navigate that space between, you know, the academic sphere and like the games community, because a lot of times there's overlap in those spaces, especially when we start talking about people being in the games critics, people being game scholars. I mean, there should be, right? Because all too often academics do stuff like they talk about people and not talk to people or with people. And that's been one of my biggest things, is to make sure, I mean, cause I'm a gamer first. And you know, like I said, I've been doing this 8 years. I'm an academic by trade, but I'm also a middle-aged black woman, right? I mean, I've been playing games for 40 years. In fact, you know, now 42 years. So, you know, I'm a gamer first. So, you know, to navigate that space and bring all those things together has always been super important for me.
One of the things I love about kind of the space that we occupy now is, and I'm happy you talked a little bit about your age, because I feel like our space now has gotten to a place where we see a kind of varying degree of ages and demographics and people being kind of spoken to and spoken for. Do you feel like, because I feel like we get the chance to kind of speak to an older audience, which has been really nice. Do you feel like your crew has been able to kind of bridge those gaps, as well as kind of, you know, speak to folks who are of our own age group, but also kind of put out stuff and still be relevant to folks who may be younger than us as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely, right? And then I not only do I think that we're able to speak to kind of a multi-generational crowd, but I think that we're able to do something that is super important, and that is to make sure that folks know that, you know, gaming is not just for kids, right? It's like, oh, gaming, that's a kid's thing, right? But just thinking about representation. So for me, representation is about making myself seen as a woman, as a person of color, and as a person of a certain age, right? So all the different facets of who I am are really important to me when we start talking about making myself visible. And I think that being able to have that multi-generational conversation about games also gives us an inroads to having a multi-generational conversation about about society, about culture, about politics, about a lot of other stuff that usually we don't have those conversations about.
Yeah, as a you know, as an academic, when you first started, did you think about trying to do sort of the show and the podcast, like sort of officially, you know, like associated with, you know, with the university that you were at? Like has there been any tension between, you know, the academic side of what you do and sort of and the podcast?
There, yes and no. So yes, there's always been kind of tension between, I mean, come on, it's games work, right? Especially when I started, yeah, it was games work. Especially when I started doing games work, from an academic standpoint, that's been almost 20 years ago, right? And people were looking at me funny, was like, but that's not scholarship. That's not academic, right? And I was having a conversation with someone about this the other night, is that I think what was different for me as an academic coming into this space is that before I became an academic, right, in terms of working at a university, I was a public school teacher in the city of Detroit. And I went back to grad school and became and got my PhD. So for me, it was not so much, I didn't feel like I had so much to lose, because I don't want to say I had a fallback career, but if they decided that they didn't want me because of the work that I was doing and decided to fire my black ass, I could go get another job.
right.
So, you know, so I had a security blanket of sorts. Mm-hmm. So that was always super important to me. But yeah, there was always some question about, you know, the academic nature of the work that I was doing. Now the question of what, did I ever want to connect it to the university? No, because I'm the child of a black activist of the 60s and 70s, and I wanted to keep my work my own. So I always made sure that my work was not officially connected to the university. I never used university hardware. I never stored my stuff on university servers, because if you work at a university or an academic of any sort, you know that once you do that, everything you produce in that space with those things belongs to the university.
Right.
So I always had my own hosting. I always had my own hardware.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that thing that you said about 20 years ago, people kind of looking at you saying that it's not scholarship.
Yeah.
I taught a game class as an adjunct this last semester, and the main professor, like assistant professor that like I taught it, said she goes through the same thing like in 2018.
Yeah.
Having to, you know, like not justify it to her superiors, because obviously, you know, they hired her for it. But when she's at networking events, or she's, you know, at education conferences or like that kind of stuff, that she still finds herself, you know, people saying like, what are you doing with games? Like, how can that be an actual thing? So unfortunately, you know, it's still there.
Yeah. The struggle is there.
Struggle is real. Now, is that a generational thing? Is that something that you find that people that are your age, and, you know, and you're probably a little bit ahead of the curve, but, you know, maybe younger professors or younger academics as you run into them, that are, you know, maybe perhaps in their late 20s and 30s and mid to late 30s, do they understand the academic nature, the scholarship that is gaming?
I would like to say yes, but no. I'd like to say yes, but no. If they're in games, they tend to. But younger folks who are coming into game studies now are still running, like we've just said, are still running into these issues. I mean, and they're running into these issues with their colleagues, right? Colleagues of the same age, that are like, but that's not scholarship, right? That's not rigorous enough, right? Because they don't understand what we do. They all think that, you know, what we do is sitting around. Well, we do sit around playing games. Got to play games. but right. we read games differently, right? We read them as text. They don't understand that. Right. And they don't understand that there's an entire body of scholarship, you know, that's been going for more than two decades at this point that surrounds games.
It's so perplexing to me because, you know, video games and interactive entertainment as a medium is just the evolution of art, you know, of popular art. I mean, yeah. you know, there was scholarship for paintings and sculptures and what have you. No one would balk at someone who is a film, you know, a film history professor. And you know, people easily can understand the scholarship and the amount of detail that can be gleaned from watching film and studying cinema. Why would you then look at this interactive entertainment, this medium that you've enjoyed for your entire life, the same way you've enjoyed movies, the same way you've enjoyed books and art or sculptures and classical art? Why would you look at video games any differently? It's just asinine.
Yeah,
that's it. We're done.
What's the hardest part to kind of convey to folks when you do have that discussion? Is it just is it just the connection to the idea that it's for kids, or is it something that they just haven't figured out the value of yet and don't know how to convey that and connect that part to the ability to kind of talk about it and teach about it from an academic standpoint?
I think it is both, that, you know, the feeling that, you know, games are for kids, one, two, and not having an understanding of the medium, not understanding that games have the ability to convey some real viewpoints and give us the opportunity to engage on a number of different issues. But I think it's also that it's an elitist thing, right? In the same way that you get folks who talk about, you know, the difference between, say, teaching, I don't know, comics or graphic novels, and teaching high literature, right? So, you know, was like, that's not real scholarship because, you know, that's, you know, something for the dirty, unwashed masses. I think that's a huge part of it.
Please stop talking about them Skyrim people like that. They're just trying to live their lives. Just trying to get their meat on. A quick question I have for you is a little bit outside of the realm of the academic space, but you know, starting from that place, and now, you know, being 8 years into the podcasting game, you've now had to become a part of entertainment itself. You've become an entertainer in some way, in some fashion, because you're doing that for the audience that you've built. What has that kind of transition been in getting into that space now and being like, you know, I'm doing my academic work, I'm doing my podcasting stuff, but now I have to like entertain the people when I get on and rock out.
It's been fun, right? I think that's probably another reason folks are a little tentative about, you know, games in academia, right? Because apparently doing scholarship, being an academic, is not supposed to be fun.
Right.
But, you know, I'm sorry. If it's not fun, I don't want to do it. I mean, right. I have worked too long and too hard to be, you know, to continue to do work that is not enjoyable to me. I love games. Like I said, I've been playing games for 42 years. I don't intend to ever stop, right? I mean, I look at my mother, who is older. I'm not going to say her age because she would kill me.
Yes.
But she started, I'm going to say a little bit, right? She started gaming in her 70s to play games with my daughter.
Awesome.
Dope.
Huh. So they get together and they get out their little DSs and they're playing games, or they're playing games on the Switch. And and this is not just a thing when she's like visiting. I mean, she will like call me up and be like, I bought this new game.
Dope.
So, dope. You know,
that's so dope.
It's important for me for this whole thing to be enjoyable because, you know, it's work that I dedicate a lot of my time and a lot of my life to. But I also see it as being important work, right? Because there are conversations that need to be had. And this is a space for me, not only as an academic, but also as an activist, to have these kinds of conversations. So, you know, I see it as putting in work, but it's also putting in work that's fun. And, you know, I mean, at some point it might, I don't know, it might not be fun anymore, right? You know, the podcasting, you know, the podcasting, the blogging, the writing about games, the streaming. I don't know if that's going to be not fun at some point, but right now I'm having a blast.
That's what's up.
I dig that.
Yeah, that's I think that that's excellent. And like the not fun part, I know that, you know, we've had some crazy happenings over the last years with like Gamergate stuff and sort of other things that, you know, other, like, not that that was the first time that harassment has ever happened by any means, but like it kind of put it onto another level in terms of the mainstream conversation. So being in this space for 8 years and, you know, kind of seeing that much of like the ebbs and flows of the conversations of diversity and inclusion, where do you think that the gaming community is at now? Do you think that they're at a better place than they were kind of when you first started kind of like doing this? Or like, do you think that it's kind of around the same or like a little worse?
That's a good question. I think it's, I don't know that it's a better or worse place, but I think it's a different place.
Okay.
So,
expertly done, by the way. That's an expert answer.
Right. I think, that's that whole PhD rhetoric thing. I can switch it up on you. but we're at a place now where, you know, 8 years ago or 10 years ago, we had a very specific kind of reaction to the work that we do when we started talking about, when we started talking about like race, and we started talking about feminism, and we started to talk about queerness in games, and people were like, don't bring that shit in my games. Now, you know, 8 years later, we still got people like, don't bring that shit in my games. But now, I think the problem is that the folks, the voices that are there and speaking out against the work that we do are more organized. And have been given more power than they've, a different kind of power. Let me say that, right? Because if we talk about like the power in terms of Gamergate and a lot of those earlier conversations, even is that a lot of it was kind of veiled or explicit, you know, physical threats, right? And those are real. Those are real. Those are, and not to be made light of. But that existed before games and Gamergate. That's been women in the tech industry for decades. So, I mean, but now we have these different kinds of conversations, and I swear before all of this, holy, I get pissed off whenever I see folks giving more power to these voices than needs to be given, right? When we have, and I'm not talking about, I'm not even talking about recent happenings, but happenings longitudinally, right? Where game companies have these knee-jerk reactions and start firing people based on, some of these conversations that are being had, right? And in effect, what that does is that starts to silence women and people of color and queer folks who actually want to make some kind of real change in not only games and the games industry, but the games community that surrounds games. And that's disturbing. But that's a whole different, like I said, there's a different kind of power behind these voices now. And, you know, I could, you know, wax poetic and talk about why I think this power is different in 2018 than it was in, you know, 2010. But it's different. It's a different kind of power.
Well, it's a different power than people had in 2016.
Yes.
If, you know, or at least before November 3rd or 6th, 2016. it's, you know, and you got to speak, you got to stop speaking so much truth to power right now, Sam, because some white person may come along our Twitch stream and call the cops on us.
Yeah. Come on now. Okay, wait. Are you trying to say that ain't never happened to you before? Because that's happened to me before.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
While like podcasting / streaming?
While actively doing it, no. But yeah, it's happened to me before.
Oh.
Do you mean in terms of like swatting stuff?
Yes.
Or like... Oh,
you've been swatted?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus. Some of my bitch.
Really? Whoa. Wow. That's madness. That's no joke.
People get mad at me.
You're okay.
They get mad at me.
I mean.
Well, it's not, yeah.
It's not. There's no reason. Right. There's no reasonable reason for swatting anyone. Right. But the first thing that I thought, I was like, "What did you say?" I was like, "What you do?"
Oh yeah, I have a real lives. Ability to piss people off. Apparently,
yeah.
I bet you all you did was tell truth.
Yeah. No, they get mad. Yeah.
Truth hurts a lot more than a lie, man. The truth cuts to the bone. A lie you can brush off. You know, on to better topics. So you are a self-proclaimed passionate gamer. When you close your eyes and you think about your love for games, what are the top three games that come into your brain?
Oh gosh. Top three games coming to my brain when I close my eyes. All right. So I'm gonna try to pick games from three different genres.
Okay.
If I have to pick three games, I'm going to say The Longest Journey, which was a point and click adventure game.
Yeah.
I will say a game that's recently kind of really stuck with me and hit me hard, Mafia 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Blackest game ever made.
Yeah, it was black as hell, wasn't it? What's going to be my third one? See, I didn't use up the first two, and I'm like, this got to make this one good. Got to make this one good.
Stuff.
Ni No Kuni.
That's a good pick.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I like appreciate you trying to pick it from different genres, because I always struggle with those questions, because I'm like, do I just answer like three Zelda games? Because I really like Zelda a lot, you know, like you got to try to like, you know, take some from here and there. So I like how you kind of like really picked from various things. That was cool.
I had a quick question. I want to bring it back to the streaming and the podcasting really fast.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I love that you all do is you all stream and do events for hard charities. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that you all do that. And you all have been doing charity work for a long time. I'm gonna go back on the page right now and look. Since like 2015, you've all been doing your various kinds of charity events. How has it been? First of all, how hard is it to raise funds for the not conventional versions of charities? I know we struggle with it, doing Small for Good. I know when y'all are doing stuff, it's like, please tell people at home just how hard it is when you're asking people for money for stuff that is not the usual stuff.
Okay, you ain't never lied. Okay, so we've been doing charity stuff. So 2015 was the year we started doing Gaming for Good, right? Which is when we said we're gonna break outside of the norm, and we're not gonna do kind of the traditional charities that people raise money for when they play in games.
Right.
Before that, we had spent years. Probably since before, since the beginning, right? Raising money for stuff like Extra Life and doing the Extra Life Marathon every year. And 2015 was the year that I was like, you know what? There's a lot of shit going on in the world that is not, you know, that we're not raising money for. Now, when we were raising money for Extra Life, we would get an Extra Life team together. We'd raise $4,000, $6,000, $8,000, $10,000.
That's dope.
At a time, but we'd have a larger team, right? Mm-hmm. When we started raising money for some of these smaller charities, right? You know, stuff like legal defense for immigration, right? Stuff like suicide hotlines for queer folks, how to reintegrate veterans into society when they're struggling, right? So when we started doing stuff that people that, you know, you can't dress up And it's not just, you know, not just right, cute children. Right. It got mm-hmm. hard, right? Mm-hmm. We struggle to raise a couple thousand dollars sometimes, most times, right?
Right.
But for me, bringing awareness to these causes and bringing awareness to these charities has right. been super important, because it also has given us an opportunity to talk to folks about how important some of these causes are. And we choose causes that are near and dear to us, right? Not the Extra Life, you know, wasn't, right? Because it was Children's Miracle Network hospitals. Right. My daughter had treatment at a Children's Miracle Network hospital when she was born. So that was, you know, always something that was important. But there are all these other charities as well that just kind of get ignored because, you know, it's like stuff people are ashamed to talk about, right? Or scared to talk about. Yep. You know, because I was our last event was for raising money for legal defense for children, right, who've been separated from their parents, shall we say, kidnapped at the border, right? And I'm like, oh, we gonna catch all kinds of shit about this. But they're important charities, and that's been just as important to me. As anything else, and bringing awareness to some of these causes, has been super super important.
Yeah, it's dope. I applaud you all because we're in that struggle too, of trying to figure out how to. It's weird because you don't want to, and this is gonna sound terrible, but I can't find the words because it's been a long day. I can't find eloquent words for it. But it's like you don't want to crap on the stuff that's already happening in those spaces,
right?
Like, Extra Life is a great charity, and, like, of course, you want to support people who are, like, supporting sick children and all that stuff.
Right.
But it is that, like, weird epiphany where you're just like, there are so many other organizations that really, really don't get any funding.
Yeah.
Right.
That
right.
don't get any extra money absolutely. From nowhere else. And mm-hmm. they're, like, doing a lot of dope work, and gaming folks just don't want to touch it because it feels like it's political and it's kind of dirty in some right. weird way.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your politics.
Yeah, it's weird though, right? Because it's like, again, like the stuff that you're all doing, it absolutely has a political twinge to it because it kind of has to. And it's so much more difficult to kind of raise funds and awareness for that stuff. Have you figured out any other tactics and kind of ways that you want to frame things for people when it comes to the fact that you are a podcast and writing about all these political issues that are connected to the games that we play? Have you figured out ways to kind of give people the medicine, you know, give them the stuff they need in the medicine that they actually need?
Dang, you make it sound like you like the medicine.
But it's good though. I mean, it's good medicine, right? You know,
it's good medicine. You know, so the thing has been, even like from the beginning on the podcast, on the blog, even in my more quote unquote official scholarship, I've always tried to make my work accessible to folks outside of academia. Right. Mm-hmm. Like we were talking about Mafia 3. I've talked a lot about Mafia 3. I've written a lot about Mafia 3. I've published in academic venues about Mafia 3. But it's not, you know, it has to be tied to something else, right? So we're talking about Mafia 3, talking about like connections to representation of right life in that whole Louisiana, Mississippi basin, right? That we see in literature, but then I tie it to stuff like music, right? So I'm tying it to not only the music that we're listening to when we play the game, but also music that kind of harkens back to that same feeling, that same tone in contemporary times. So, you know, like I published a piece in an academic journal that was talking about Mafia 3, Octoroon Balls, and Beyonce.
That's awesome.
Can that be a t-shirt?
Right.
Can that be like the like Emmett, the like unlike shirts for all the black people who died? You just lay like all that stuff down on a shirt and then you just like, all the things.
I mean, mean, but that's the work that I'm doing, because I feel like this is my life's work, and my life's work needs to make some kind of change in order for it to be important for me. Like I said, I'm the child of an activist from the 60s and 70s, right? You know, my mother ran a women and children's clinic on the east side of Detroit in the 60s and in the 70s. So, you know, here we're talking about, you know, not only women's rights, but we're also talking about a very specifically raced and classed group of women. And so it feels disingenuous to me to not pay some kind of homage to that in my own work.
Right.
Right. Because that's the way I was raised.
Word. It makes sense. It makes so much sense. Like, you can see the lineage just kind of going through the work right now. It's just like, anytime you all drop a thing, I'm just like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. That totally makes sense. What makes sense for us as well is to take a quick break. We have some more stuff on the back end of episode 245. Everybody chill out in the chat. Everybody chill out in podcast land and Twitch land, and we'll be right back after this.
What up, Bricago? We are the crew of the Optional Podcast, coming to you each week from New York City, where we host a show all about the latest in video games and entertainment. Our show is for everybody looking for a fresh new take on gaming culture and how it intersects with movies, music, anime, food, and whatever else we love. Check us out at theoptionalpodcast.com.
We're available on iTunes, Google Play, and all major podcast services. This isn't your typical gaming podcast.
This is video game commentary for the rest of us.
What's good, internet? This is Austin Walker, aka Professor Killer, aka David Foster Flawless, aka Bars Von Trier. You already know what it is. And since you do, you should also already know that Spawn on Me keeps it real when it comes to games, culture, and holding it down even when the world is on fire. Welcome to Bricago, y'all.
Welcome back to the Spawn on Me podcast, episode 245 of our show. Chillin'. We are rocking with Samantha Blackman from Not Your Mama's Gamer, hanging out, doing our thing. I want to dig into a little bit of news of the week as we close out the rest of this show. There's a couple of really good articles that came out and some good stories that I want to dig into. First of all the folks over at Hello Games have been doing a lot of work in the past couple months. They've been doing stuff in the past, actually like past year or so, to kind of revamp and give some love to their game No Man's Sky, that came out to, as everyone knows, the not best of of launches, and came out with a lot of angry folks who were not excited about the actual game and what they were offered. But I will say, in the way that The Division and For Honor and there's a couple of Warframe, they have come back with some really cool stuff, and it feels like now they are ready to kind of hit the level that they would have probably launched with if they had been given the time. They have a new trailer that's out, and they have a new update that's going to be happening next week, where they have multiplayer in the game, stuff that they wanted to get done. They're going to do a whole bunch of space fleets and all that kind of stuff. I'm excited for the update. It's going to be No Man's Sky Next is what it's going to be called. And it's finally going to be launching on the Xbox system. Next Man's Sky. That sounds like something that happens when you come home from the club, you drunk. Right. It's like, man, I got that Next Man's Sky, man. I thought I had all the stuff. Is anybody else excited for this game besides me? I'm kind of excited for it. I'm waiting to dig back into this game. I'm gonna go to C first. C, what do you think about No Man's Sky Next being a thing? Well, especially because now that you're an Xbox player, you'll be able to play it.
Right. Well, I mean, we talked about your man in them skies. You know, if they come out with that joint with, like, you know, you get the Bubble Goose and the Tim's pack, costume pack, then maybe I'll be excited about it. And it's not, I'm not throwing shade on it at all. I'm not excited about it. And the reason I'm not excited about it, again, is because my space exploration game, my time-wasting space sci-fi game is Elite Dangerous. which just had another update. So what I think this news is showing is and we've talked about some other things that have come out with games over the last year and 18 months is we're showing that the game designers and games companies and publishers are becoming more receptive to the idea of games as a service. These games are built to have, you know, almost never ending tales. And the game that you buy today, hopefully, is just a less mature version of the game of that same title that you're playing 18 months, 24 months, 36 months from now. You can be proud that you can take the time to reflect back to, oh, remember what it was like when, and look at the game and say, oh, wow, they've really given it the time to mature now that it's out in the wild and really become the thing that they kind of tried to envision. Mm. Or even more than that.
Yeah. Reef, what are your thoughts about No Man's Sky getting an update, a huge update, and kind of re-flourishing in the space that they kind of helped to create?
I agree with C on the games as a service point, though I don't agree with it at a $60 price point. That's normally the problem that I've had with even games like Destiny and such, where that they've kind of slowly built up, is I think the expectation when you drop the full price on a game is that it is complete and that everything else is sort of like cherries on top. Whereas what you see with No Man's Sky and this game and even games like The Division and, you know, and like For Honor is that the extra stuff isn't cherries on top. The extra stuff is like fixing major, major, major issues or like adding major, major parts that were considered like either fundamentally broken or stuff that like people, you know, felt like probably screamed about it, but would have accepted a delay of the game before it came out to go in there. With that said, I wouldn't say I'm super duper excited about this, but I'm hoping that it puts No Man's Sky back in my rotation, because when No Man's Sky first came out, it was the perfect like before bed game, or the perfect like just throw in for an hour and just zone out game. And that did wear on me a bit, because if you did it for a little while, you started to see like the similarities and sort of like the, sameness of the aliens and the worlds. Now with the last update, they changed a lot of that, to make it a little more interesting. And with this one, it's a even larger one. So, you know, I feel like if you have an expectation that it's just kind of a Minecraft, you go and chill out, and now you have the opportunity to chill out plus talk shit with your friends. I think if with that expectation, I think that it will deliver on what like Hello Games wanted in the first place, which is sort of the complete opposite of the several years of E3 marketing that you saw for it, you know, where like people were expecting in like an Elite Dangerous or like the equivalent of like a Star Trek or Star Wars kind of like, you know, game. So, you know,
so the first time I'm going to quote someone who's actually already on the show via a tweet that they said earlier in the day, said by Sharif Jackson of sharifjackson.com. He says, I love hearing about the resurgence of games like The Division and No Man's Sky. This proves the narrative that games have to be either wild successes from the start or absolute failures. I love that tweet, because I feel like that is the kind of thing that we're seeing right now, right? It's like we have a whole bunch of games that are kind of coming into the space, and it feels like we're going to talk about it with the next story that we do about games that come out the gate and don't really do well. It's hard to see how games are going to kind of make that turnaround once they make a bad push. Samantha, what are your thoughts about No Man's Sky in general? And also, what do you think about the update that's coming out?
So I played No Man's Sky when it first came out. And when I'm super excited about a game, a lot of times what I'll do is I'll go media dark on it. So I didn't have some of the same expectations that other folks had when No Man's Sky came out. So when it came out, and it was really kind of a, you know, like Sharif said, it was kind of a chill out experience, right? It was something I would play when I just wanted to chill. And I was like, I'm going to put in some music. I'm going to have a drink. I'm going to sit here and I'm gonna play this game, and I'm going to float around in space, and I'm going to go around and collect stuff and do stuff. And I really enjoyed it when I thought about it that way, but I didn't have the same expectations that other people had because I didn't get the same promises because I wasn't listening to the same kind of marketing about the game that other folks was. So that was a whole lot better for me. Now, that being said, I'm kind of excited about the update. No Man's Sky Next, the way I'm understanding it is the update is going to be free on PlayStation, but you know, you have to buy, if you're going to play it on a different console, you're going to buy a new copy. And I will actually, you know, I hate to say this, but I will probably buy, or otherwise procure a copy of, just make it sound like I'm about to walk into Best Buy and lift a copy.
You don't need that. Let me hold that for you.
No, my brother, you got to get your own.
But I'm probably going to get a copy, Xbox copy, because, you know, most of the folks that I game with on a regular basis, are playing on Xbox, and I want to play the multiplayer. Right. I want to play the, you know, that is that, you know, being able to talk shit with your friends while you explore space, that kind of thing is what I'm really looking forward to. Now, that being said, right, when we start looking at, you know, companies that are releasing DLC, right, to make the game what it should have been when it first came out, you know, I think companies are doing this because you can't hit a $60 price point for 10 years. And have the same quality game.
Unless you're Rockstar,
right? Right. But they don't want to raise the price of games. You know what? I'd rather go ahead and pay $69.99 instead of $59.99 or $79.99 instead of $59.99 and not have to buy, you know, three different, either a season pass or three different DLC packages over the course of the next 18 months. So...
Yeah.
So, man, I understand the logic behind that sentiment. I really do. The problem with it is if you think for a second that the prices of the title will raise to $80 or $70 or even $90 and they still won't charge you for DLC, you're absolutely bananas. You know, I mean, it's just not happening. But to be fair, and you know, and we've got to paint both sides of this argument right now. We're talking about No Man's Sky, and we're talking about Elite Dangerous, the Division, and For Honor. Most of the DLC that has released for these games has been included with the purchase price. So Kyle spent $60. If I were to buy No Man's Sky on the Xbox when it releases, I'd pay the same price, and if you account for inflation, less than Kyle did when he purchased No Man's Sky, to get a much more full game. A much fuller experience. Elite Dangerous had one update that was like $40. The game, like I said, has been out for 3 years. It was $40, and they have done like seven updates in between that time. And there are portions of the game, like you can still only buy the game and still experience all of most of the stuff from the updates. But if you don't get the Horizons DLC, there are certain parts that are locked away. But if I can play this game for 5 years and all I spent is $90, I'm good. I'm good. And, you know, The Division has been free outside of their season pass. So there is a mixture of both in there. And I think that manufacturers or publishers get excoriated a little too easily about the DLC About their DLC culture of the past. I think they've gotten much better about that as they've started to embrace this games as a service culture that we're currently in.
Yeah. On the flip side of that, we see the folks over at Xavient who just put out, literally last week, the sequel to their game, The Culling, mm-hmm. called The Culling 2. What an original name. to basically... No one, hardly anyone played the game. At the time of launch, more people were playing the first game than the actual new sequel that just came out. So much so that the company decided a week later after launch to pull the entire project out of existence.
Wow.
They literally have pulled the game and they're calling up all the kind of store owners, Sony and Xbox and Steam, and saying, basically, yo, you got to pull this joint because it's making us look bad. We put out a bad game. One of the folks, Van Veeld from the studio, I'm believing that he is the director on the game. He said, it's been difficult for us to wrap our heads around the entire situation. He said, The Culling 2 was not a game that you asked for, and it's not the game you expect as a worthy successor to The Culling. Weirdly enough, there's a couple of things that I'm thinking of. First of all, who the hell wanted a Culling 2? I don't remember Culling 1 being the game that everyone was like, yo, mom, can you get me the Culling game? Like, can you put down them ducats so I can get the Culling game? Two, I've never seen something like this happen before in the gaming industry. I haven't seen a game, like even Radical Heights didn't do this badly when it came out. Like Radical Heights from Boss Key, now defunct Boss Key, did at least a couple of weeks where it was doing fairly okay.
Yeah.
And then it kind of folded. I've not seen this before. Has anybody else in the crew seen this happen before, Reef?
I mean, I've seen it when games have been super buggy, like with Batman Arkham Knight on the PC, right. where Warner Brothers pulled it off of Steam for months, you know, because it was just in an unplayable state. So when I first heard about this, I thought that's what happened.
Yeah.
But as far as I'm seeing it, it's not unplayable. It's just that it just sold very poorly. Like, did you see anything that said it had some game-breaking bugs or something? Because otherwise, I've never seen someone pull something because of, like, week one performance. Like that.
I heard that the graphics looked a little muddy.
Yeah, but that's
that's not right.
Yeah. Like, it wasn't like my game keeps crashing or I can't, you know, do this kind of thing like it was with Arkham Knight, you know.
Right.
I've never seen a game get pulled before I'm able to get a review copy for it. I put it for a review copy, and then the day after it, they were like, "Yeah, we pulling this shit off the store." It's crazy. Samantha, what are your thoughts about The Culling 2 and it getting pulled as soon as it came out? Basically,
that was amazing. It was interesting when the game came out. I was like, but. And that was my big question is, like, who played The Culling?
Right.
So, you know, what made them go, let's make another one? There have been lots of games that were like horribly broken at launch. And, you know, folks patched them or, you know, apologized profusely or whatever they were going to do. But to ever see them, like, just literally snatch it off the shelves and be like, nope, you can't even buy this anymore. A totally new thing.
This is like the Battle Royale version of PT.
Yeah.
Oh my God. See, what are your thoughts real quick before you
move on? Man, listen, I wasn't checking for the game. It is wild. I've never heard of anything like this happening for a game that was technically fine. The only time I've heard about this is when, you know, people find out that a game is misrated. They discover should be an AO or something like that, and they have to pull it.
Like San Andreas or something.
San Andreas.
Yeah.
But that was almost a year into or months into the game before people realized about Hot Coffee.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
But then there were a couple of games that were going to be released on Steam. that were, you know, days away from being released, and then because of protests about the content of the game was later denied access to the store. But yeah, this is a weird thing. I guess they believe that they had something, they still had stuff, ideas left on the table that they wanted to put out into that game world. They were really passionate about the game world. And they spent time and energy to build that game and never bothered to ask if anybody wanted that outside of the studio. And the answer was a resounding no.
It was like,
really, son.
It's just sad because I feel like so many people are going to lose their jobs. Because, like, it's so expensive to make, market, and launch a game. Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing, though. They decided that they were going to basically put all the efforts that they were putting into The Calling 2 back into The Calling 1. Because that one did okay. So they're going to kind of... I'm hoping they didn't ramp up development and personnel to get Culling 2 together. And now I can totally see how that being a problem.
Shout out to Kwanzaa Tim in the stream, because he did bring up one, Afro Samurai. Afro Samurai.
Oh, I
but
didn't
Afro
remember.
Samurai was technically terrible. Like, it was... So, like, I think even the cats in, you know, and shout out to them, because they were out there trying to do it. It was a black studio that was out there, you know, trying to make a passion product. But it was objectively bad. Like, it was just, it wasn't rough around the edges. The edges were rough. Like, all of that shit was just, it was just, you know. And it was sad. Like, people just really felt bad about it too, and you know, so they probably poured some out when they were pulling that off the shelves, but they had to because it was garbage.
Yeah, real quick before we move over to the last story of the show, is this a commentary on the Battle Royale space of, like, basically you ain't getting in because Fortnite is taking over?
What?
I said, basically, you're not getting in to the Battle Royale space because Fortnite is basically soaking up all the space.
No, because, you know, it ebbs and flows. Because, you know, I think later on this year, we're going to wind up having a conversation about NBA basketball and NBA basketball video games. And I have a sense that the tide is turning yet again.
NBA Battle Royale? You know,
NBA Battle Royale. Well, what I'm saying is, so there are games, there are, you know, there are flashes in the pan, there are hot things in games and hot genres and hot games in that genre for a time, and then it dies down a little, or somebody does something different in the space that people gravitate towards. And, you know, right now, this space has really been occupied mostly, or most specifically, by two games. So, you know, one game offered, you know, both games offer the same thing, but in very different ways. And if some other games, we've got Battlefield, we've got Call of Duty, some really big publishers that are coming out with Battle Royales, there is an opportunity for them to present the same thing in a way that really appeals to gamers in a very different way. And we can't predict that the genre is stale or the genre is done because they've got a champion. You're never the champion forever, man.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And I want to say that the only basketball battle royale game to have ever been made was Arch Rivals. That is that game.
Facts.
It was
2-2. Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's, like, plenty of space. I mean, I don't think this says much about the, I guess you can call it a genre. I mean, it's really a two-game thing. But, you know, like Realm Royale, you know, the old Paladins game has gotten some buzz because of its kind of like mechanics and stuff. I think there's a lot of niches that you can fill as long as you don't set your expectations like we got to dethrone Fortnite to profit, you know what I'm saying? Like,
right. yeah
like there's like plenty of space for like smaller games with more modest goals and ideas that aren't currently done you know, in the Fortnites and in the PUBGs. I think there's plenty of room for that. I think this was just a game that didn't offer anything and probably should have never came out.
Damn. Off with their heads again from Reef. Damn. last story of the night and for episode 245 is one talking about the king of the hill when it comes to Battle Royale games, Fortnite. And a really dope article that stemmed from some conversations happening on Twitter, as per usual. Sharky over from Thumbstick Mafia crew, mad shout out to them and massive love to them. There was a conversation that sort of sparked maybe 2 weeks ago or so, in which I saw the first kind of conversation coming from Malik Forte, talking about how Fortnite is implementing more emotes. They implement emotes pretty much every week and throw in new ones. A lot of them, if you are not familiar, have lots of dances that come from popular culture, many of them coming from hip hop culture. And there was a new one that got put out called the Swipe. So the Swipe is literally the Millie Rock
right
dance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Malik kind of brought that up on his feed. And he was like, yo, I really wish that, you know, 2 Millie would get some credit for kind of originating the dance and bringing it to the popular culture. A couple days later or a day later, Chance the Rapper jumped on the conversation and it had the same sentiment. So Sharky wrote this fantastic post that's called Fortnite Dance Emotes Epic Should Do Better, where she kind of lays out the conversation about how Epic should be giving folks who have helped to kind of popularize and make these dances deserve some form of attribute those dances right, to those right. people in some right. form or fashion within right. the game. And it's an interesting conversation on a lot of different levels, right? The sentiment about, you know, just giving credit where credit is due, the conversation about the continuing of Black culture being kind of taken from and borrowed from without giving credit. And there's some other, you know, layers to that conversation as well. I want to go around the table and I want to start off with Samantha, because I think being an academic and having had, I'm sure, some of these conversations in other forums, I would love to get your take on what you think about the kind of need to kind of give credit where credit is due in this space.
Yeah, when I saw this conversation start happening on Twitter, I was like, oh, yeah, well, I mean, come on, we're used to this, right? Not that we're used to it and it shouldn't change, right? But
right.
but the misappropriation of Black culture is something we've seen forever, right? it is what gets taken from us and never attributed to us. And yeah, I mean, why not, right? You have okay, I'm in the middle of Central Indiana. And I see, you know, every farm bred white child in Central Indiana doing you know, quote unquote Fortnite dances, right?
Right.
And not understanding anything about like where the dances come from, anything about, you know, and they're like, oh, hip hop. And I'm like, you don't even understand what hip hop is. Come on. But they have this lack of understanding. That's what I should say. I don't want to say understandings. They don't have an understanding. Right. And yeah, I mean, it's time to start attributing some of that to the folks, who create these things, who create the music, who create the dances, who create the culture that is being misappropriated by games, by folks, by films, by, you know, everything and everyone. To use the famous phrase, fuck you, pay me, right? People need to be paid for their work. So, yeah.
Word. I'm sorry, Reef, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the question is like, what method should you attribute, like how can that work? So I know that, for example, when you see these like stupid commercials that use some random like hip hop track in it, you know, they actually got to pay to get that track and all that stuff. So right. it's kind of right. obvious there. I saw some chatter of people saying, well, just include a sample of the song, you know, like license the rights to, you know, the song mm-hmm. that features the dance, just like, you know, any commercial or TV show mm-hmm. like would do. I could see that getting a little expensive. I mean, I think that like that would be cool, but I feel like at the very least, like just link out, like right, like just like have some way to instantly click and like either buy the song or something like that, you know? Because I think it should be a little more than saying this is from this. There should actually be some sort of revenue model where either like, as I said, Epic is paying to license the actual songs or parts of the songs, or they're providing like an easy mechanism to financially support, you know, these like artists that are, you know, adding to popular culture. I mean, I agree with the F you pay me thing. I think it would be dope if like they had one of those options, or like maybe there's a better option out there that like I'm not thinking about.
See what are your thoughts on that?
You know, before Reef started talking, I was thinking about, you know, what is a viable solution, and that is a viable solution where they take enough of the sample of the song so that they actually have to pay licensing fees to the people that have largely been credited, you know, that the streets will acknowledge are the people that are the progenitors of the dance craze or you know, whatever it is. But my real question is, what's Epic's incentive to do so? You know, they're making money hand over fist because kids are going out and they're buying these stupid emotes. You know, again, Uncle Cicero last week got to witness all three of his niece and nephews doing these Fortnite dances, only one of whom actually knows what the game is and has played the game. So they are, you know, these aren't siblings. So two of them don't have a game console. One does have a game console. They live close to each other, but they don't hang out. So it's not like they've seen them outside of watching their friends do them, and they're part of, it's just part of the culture now. It's part of the lexicon. It's just part of, yeah, exactly. It's part of the zeitgeist. Just like, you know, here we go. I'm going to date myself. Just like, Where's the Beef? Just like, you know, just like a subsection of kids spelled relief, R-O-L-A-I-D-S. You know, just like, what's up? You know, like all of these things become part of popular culture just because they're part, like, you know, they become just part of the zeitgeist because they become pervasive. And what Epic has been able to do has been to capitalize on that stuff and monetize that for themselves. And yeah, that stuff came from somebody else, but they're able to monetize it. I mean, the same way that people are monetizing their IG feeds and their Snapchats and all the other stuff as they're jumping out of their cars like fucking idiots to dance to that Drake song because they're in their feelings, you know? So, like, should they be given 3 cents of every 5 cents that they make back to Drake? Because they're clearly playing his song while they're dancing and driving, you know, and kicking up their insurance because their insurance carrier now sees them letting their car ride by itself. You know, so like I morally, I agree with you, Reef. But the capitalist in me, the Republican in me says, what's their incentive to actually do that? What do they gain by that?
I'm gonna jump in at the end and be not devil's advocate, but I'm kind of in the space that C is in because of a couple of things. Like, one, I, from what I can tell from being a person who plays it often enough, I don't think any of the music that we see in either the Save the World or the ones that go along with the emotes are licensed music. I think it's all original music that has influences from whatever the particular kind of theme of the particular emote is. So I don't know if that's a thing where you can be like, yo, you owe me ASCAP and BMI money. Like, I don't think that's a thing that's there. The influence part is where I have a little bit of trouble, where I love the conversation about if you pay me, because I feel like, again, Black culture gets borrowed from all the time, and there right. is this very rare, it's very rare where you see someone have the ability to kind of make money off of the thing that they've made, especially when it becomes something that gets pushed into popular culture, especially from Black folk. The thing that I have trouble with is, and I saw this conversation happen maybe last year or maybe the year before that, was one in which we saw the conversation about, like, when viral things happen, do you get to monetize that thing in a way that behooves you, but only after a bigger brand takes it, right? Mm-hmm. So there was, like, the conversation about, I don't think it was a dance, but it was like a viral tweet or a hashtag. Like, people were trying to monetize hashtags that got viral, right, and all that kind of stuff. And my question to everybody here and at home is, as much as I want people to prosper off the stuff that they make, is there just a level of, like, you have to give it up to the universe? You know what I mean? Like, there's a level of stuff where if you've made a thing, and it, you luckily got it into a place that got seen by a lot of people and it caught on.
Right.
Is there a level of that that just is like, yo, this just magic, hey, it's just happenstance that it got big, and I shouldn't necessarily look to try to figure out a way to necessarily make money off that particular thing because it just got caught on by something else? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if, you know, like, Soulja Boy has made money off of his dances. I don't know if 2 Milli,
he smoked all of that,
but that's what I'm saying. It's like, I don't know if 2 Milli, when 2 Milli made his dance, wherever he was at,
right,
was like, I want to make money off this thing. He did that thing because it was dope to him, and he gave it up to the universe, and the universe was like, yo, that's dope.
Yep.
And Epic was a part of the universe and was like, yo, we got a game called Fortnite, and we gonna borrow that joint.
Yeah.
And we're gonna make money off of it.
Someone in the chat brought up 2K. I'll bring up and they're right. I'll bring up Madden. So there are in sports games, they borrow from the culture. They use their animators to borrow from the culture very liberally, and we don't seem to have a problem with that. And in the case of 2K, they definitely monetize your ability to use the culture in your game, in the form of emotes, celebrations, what have you. And we don't seem to mind it because those games are more closely associated to the culture.
But could you also be like, yo, I just did the Cicero dance and now I need to patent the Cicero dance. And if you
I can't. I agree with you 100%. I put it out in the universe. Yo, two dances from, again, I'm playing, it's as Uncle Cicero coming back because I'm going to be an old man. But who made the Pee Wee Herman song? The brand new dance called the Pee Wee Herman.
Right.
Right. Who made the WAP song?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, we know what they are. We know those dances. Right. Easy. But I couldn't tell you who the person was. Now, back then, I might have been able to tell you who it was and give them props for that. But, you know, and again, in 3 years, 3-4 years, kids are going to be doing something else, and nobody's going to even think about these people. So, like, I understand the thought behind, like, yo, the cultural appropriation is real. It's time, like, you know, now that we have the technology out there and we have the means to do so, we should give the people, the creators, their due. But they're not going to get it because the big bad corporations aren't incentivized to do that. And let's be honest, it doesn't make any sense because they spend the time to make their money on the stuff and then they move on to something else.
Yeah, you can say that about anything a company does.
Yep.
I don't think that's a valid argument to use for this. Like, they could like they're like, we're not talking, like, I don't think the conversation should be about what they can do, because a company doesn't have to do half the things that they do, right? But they make a stance and do it.
Very, very rarely. Most of the time, a company will make a stance, and this is, you know, we're treading in the philosophical debate area right now. But most of the things that companies do, there is a rationale behind. There is a thing that they get out of it, and not just the goodness of their hearts, because they have no hearts. They're not people. Corporations are not people. People.
Here's the one thing that I will say that they have done already. In terms of giving attribution to the folks who have kind of like helped the Fortnite culture grow, Ninja has a pickaxe that's not named specifically after him, but it is in reference to something that he might have said or done. It's called the Plunger. Mm-hmm. It's like a plunger with a katana kind of run through it. CDN the Third. He has a literal emote in it of one of the emotes that he has in his Twitch channel, and it has a blurb of you know, about something that he might have said, or something that he says often in his stream. I feel like there are things that they can do in terms of that,
right,
that give the folks some due or credit. I just don't know if you getting that due or credit should automatically deserve some kind of monetary compensation. That's the part that I don't necessarily think is the connective tissue that I think is real. Like, I think that you give that stuff up. Unless like you're going into that in a business sense and being like, I am literally, this thing is going to be popping and I know it's going to be popping. So let me patent it or copyright it or put it into some form or fashion in that way.
Right. Right.
Like if Pat you can Riley. Do that, if you have that forethought, right, that you can do that, I think that that's smart and you should. Pat then Riley. You can totally bring up a thing and do right. that and do that with though.
Go ahead, yeah, read. So
it's just a link, guys. It's just a link. That's all I'm saying. Just a link.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I understand. I understand deal. What you're saying.
Just a link.
I understand what you're saying. Pat Riley patented 3-peat. He also patented forward. So anytime someone has a T-shirt that says 3-peat on it, Pat Riley gets a penny and a half.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. He did patent it. Point forward.
So. Wow. Additionally, this is, you know, little known Stubby Stan fact. I really am the no bullshit, the first person ever to pop their collar. So,
good time, you know, to end Bobby the show. Made,
right. No. Like,
thanks everybody.
I literally am the first person ever to pop their collar, and then people started popping their collars, and I get no credit out of that. What? I'm just letting y'all know that when what? People pop their collars, when that was hot for a minute, it came from your boy. It really did. It really did.
I think your collar popped you. That's what happened.
Hey, you know, look, I see, and that's why you can't get money off of shit, because people be looking at you like, yeah, whatever, son. Like, oh, hold on, here's a quarter to put in your coffee cup.
Bricago,
do your dance.
Bricago, of all the Uncle Cicero shit that you heard on this show, that is some Uncle Cicero
you
shit.
Are officially like right the old black uncle there. Now. Jeez.
Oh, hell yeah. That is definitely awesome joke like that. Shout out to Grand Pooh Bear who just rolled
so
into the
you
chat.
Hear at like the cookout from your drunk uncle.
Hey, look at here. Come remember here. You don't time? Know nothing about that, young buck.
Come here, Cletus. You remember that time right. I invented ketchup? Yeah, remember that time I stepped on a tomato? I stepped on a tomato real hard and invented ketchup. You remember that time? He's like, shut the fuck up.
I was popping them collars.
Popping collars. Good
I
Lord.
I was popping collars.
Oh, all right. Anyway, any last thoughts about kind of all this stuff?
I just want to apologize to Samantha for the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, no. I feel like you screamed about how you popped your collars and put us back like 10 years.
Yeah, back to when popping collars was stoked, bro.
Any last thoughts on the whole Fortnite debacle or any other things you feel like Epic should do to kind of reconcile?
You know, I think recognition is a big thing, right? If you're not going to pay folks, no. But you know, like you said, I mean, they're selling emotes, right? So they're getting paid for it, right? If it's a penny per emote, right? Or just like some kind of recognition so that it goes outside of Fortnite, because in that case, you know, maybe it is, you know, like Sharif said, a link. Right, that people can go and like buy a song or just learn more about someone and go and buy something later, whatever. Something, I think it's just some kind of acknowledgement, some kind of, you know, to use the academic word, some kind of citation is a good thing.
Mm. Yeah. We're agreed on that. And I'm hoping that Epic doesn't brush this conversation off as something that's not necessarily worthy of, you know, internal discussion. I know that the usual conversation when it comes to appropriation sometimes, and when it comes to stuff like this, sometimes gets blown out of proportion, and sometimes, you know, gets pushed into like kind of unreasonable spaces. But I do feel like there is an underlying conversation about this in terms of gaming and Black culture specifically, where we just don't see people who understand just how much Black culture has contributed to and continues to contribute to gaming in general, which is the conversation that, you know, the reason why we have our podcast, the reason why Not Your Mom's Gaming Podcast is here, so that we can share that information out with other folks. So, Samantha, I know that it's time for us to go. Is there any dope stuff coming up from you and the crew that you want to share out and plug?
I was like, it's summer, you know, we're not on hiatus, but we try to take it a little easy in the summertime. a little bit. Well, we're always doing our Gaming for Good charity marathons. We do those quarterly. Check it out there and kind of hang out with us and see when we're doing our next marathon. You can game with us, you can donate, you can hang out, you can do whatever you're gonna do to help out some good causes. You know, we're always streaming. I'm now a partner streamer on Mixer, so you can come hang out with me over on Mixer. there's always something going on. The best thing to do is just like check, you know, keep an eye on our Twitter or my Twitter or the site's Twitter and see what's going on.
Dope. So before we get up out of here, C, it's your turn. Yeah. Tell everybody how the social media business popped your collar.
Right. If one is popping one's collar with Bricago, they go to Twitter and they put in Spawn on Me. If they want to reach us individually, check the bio. All of our information is right there. If you want to send us an email, something that's a little bit longer, you can go to spawnonmepodcast@gmail.com. For all the other social medias, find us on Spawn on Me. We are all there. We're there all the time. Check us out every Thursday, 7:30 Pacific, 10:30 Eastern, right here on Twitch, twitch.tv/spawnonme, to catch the live show. Even if there are technical problems, we will be here every Thursday. If you're not on Thursdays, every Tuesdays, we are on your favorite podcatcher. If it's a place where you can subscribe, please do so. And rate and review. Tell your friends. It really helps out. Please do that as much as possible. And if you want to go a little bit above and beyond, you want to check us out. After you go to spawnon.me, you can go to patreon.com/spawnonme and donate as little as $1 a month to get our extra show, Spawn on Me After Dark, and help us keep the lights on and keep us going to conventions. We really, really appreciate it, and we will give you more.
Speaking about conventions, we have a dope, dope, dope announcement that we want to share with everyone in Bricago. Pop your collar. If you are going to... If you are going to PAX West this year, you will get to hang out with your boys, me, Cicero Holmes, at PAX, the first ever live recording of a Spawn on Me show in front of a live audience. We are going to be chilling with two of the dopest cats in the universe, in the gaming space, Blessing Adeoye, who's coming at us from OKBeast.com, the future of gaming. I'm telling you right now, those cats are the dopeness. They are super, super dope. Super cool. Go check out their stuff, OKBeast.com. And our dude, our boy, our man, my mellow, the smooth kind of fellow, the man who rocks the power glove while playing Mario. It is Dave Hunt, a.k.a. Grand Pooh Bear.
Pooh Bear.
Our dude who has been on our show two times. He will be on the show again in live fashion. So that means that you all need to come through and roll out. If you are in the Seattle area, September 1st, 4:30, Sandworm Theater. hanging out. We are trying. We're hoping. We maybe pull another guest. I'm trying to figure out if we can snag someone else. If there are folks that you want to suggest that we maybe go look at and go check out and see if we can get them on. I really want a woman on the show to rock with us for our first our first panel, first live panel at PAX. But for real, this is like definitely a bucket list thing. And this is one of the goals that we wanted to set really early on in 2018. And now we're going to be able to do it with your help. So, you know, all the money that you've helped to support us with on Patreon is helping to figure out a way for us to get out there and rep all of everyone in Bricago. And we're going to be able to do it live. So this is going to be dope.
It is going to be dope. And also for those people who are in the stream that are watching right now, in real life, my nose is even bigger than it was in that picture.
wait, hold on. Look at that. That is 1080p nostrils right there. That's what I'm talking about right there.
When I'm around, you need to hold your breath. Because I'm sucking up all the oxygen. I'm taking it all.
I took this picture 10 feet away and his nostrils sucked me into it. So that it was like it was a close up.
They took the picture in 4K, but I sucked it up and it's just 1080p.
So, again, we're super excited at the fact that we're going to be able to do a live show with PAX. It's dope to be able to say that we had a panel at the at the big show, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We want to bring the energy. We want to bring the fun at that show, and we're going to have two dope guests who you all know and should love. So definitely come and check us out next week. Next week, we will maybe have a guest. I'm not sure yet. We'll try to figure out who we might want to snag for that. But until then, we're going to get up out of here. We're going to say peace for episode 245. Peace, y'all.
Peace.